Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday is Dr. Dean Lemery, a board-certified family medicine physician practicing in Glenville, New York, who is the medical director of Ellis Primary Care. Dr. Lemery earned his medical degree from Albany Medical College, completed his residency at Albany Medical Center. He's board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Pediatrics. He's also the author of the book, Medicine is a Team Sport, How to Become a Team Player in Your Own Healthcare. Dr. Lemery, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It's going to be an interesting show. If you have a medical problem, this is a good time to talk about it. We don't do diagnosis over the phone, but we can give you some general hints here. Let me ask you a question, Dean. The name of the book was Medicine as a Team Sport, How to Become a Team Player in Your Own Healthcare. Give us the Cliff Notes version.
Cliff Note version is to, I wrote it for patients, yeah, to help them to be able to work with their physician or whoever is involved in their health care better, because the best care is given when it's coordinated. You not only get the best care, but you get the most cost-efficient care.
Well, that's easy to say, but how hard is it to get it done? In other words, I'm an older guy now. I have a few docs here and there, an endocrinologist, or this or that. How do you get them to talk to each other?
Well, I've done it my whole career, from when I started out 27 years ago. And a lot of it's good medicine is communication. And when I see someone in your age group who's got another doctor or two,
sure,
and come to my office for something I'm treating, let's just say your high blood pressure,
sure,
copy of my note goes to your other doctors. And soon they get the message, and I get things every day from other physicians. Mm-hmm. Labs that I might do on you, I will also send a copy to whichever of your other physicians I think will be interested in them.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin, you have to get this and you have to get it going. And I think a lot of it too hinges with the primary care physician.
Well, as the old saying goes, you can lead a horse to water. So you can get the, you can get these, you can send these things out, but how do you get them to read them?
They do read them. It's interesting because other physicians are interested. Believe it or not, they are interested in, because medical disease interacts and it interplays. For example, if you're the cardiologist and I'm seeing somebody who's got diabetes, and as you know, diabetes is a risk factor for heart disease, they're interested to know, are you a well-controlled diabetic or not a well-controlled diabetic? And even just to throw something out there along that line, people don't think about their ophthalmologist, their eye doctor, who's doing an eye exam. When I send the eye doctor a note and says, hey, this person's diabetic. They're going to look a little harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, the phones are loading up, believe it or not, Dean. So
okay.
We'll start to take some calls. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Like to hear from you. It's a great day. It's going to snow. Good day to learn something. Here we go. Okay, let's go to Jim in... Jim, you're there.
Do you have any updates on the treatment of frostbite?
I don't have anything new and earth-shattering.
It's an interesting question today.
But it's certainly an interesting question. Frostbite, which is certainly is very severe exposure of the skin to very cold weather. It's a lot of pain. You can get blisters. You can actually kill off the skin and cause a lot of damage. Just as some basic things, if this happens, number one, obviously it makes sense, get out of the cold when you can. But also, when you try and warm things up, don't rub them, especially if you have blisters. Don't rub them and break them because you can potentially cause damage as well as set up for infection.
What should you do?
What you want to do is when you can, and when you can do this regularly, is you want to begin to warm the area. Don't put a hot pad right on the skin.
Right.
But you kind of want to bandage it up if you can. And you don't, when I say you want to do this when you can do it continuously, because you don't want to start warming something up and then expose it to cold air again. So when you can, get a good safe cover on it, keep it covered. begin to warm it up, start that process, and get yourself to a healthcare facility.
What about hot water?
I would not apply hot water directly to the skin. Mm-hmm. Again, if you put hot water and wrap it in cloth, but again, not directly on the skin, try and have some layers between it so you're getting the temperature, the warm temperature, but not the direct hot water.
Yeah. You know, I shouldn't tell the story, but I will. Okay. I used to have a television show on, I guess, Channel 6 in the mornings, and another one on 13. And we had a guy on, a doctor, who had saved a patient whose hand had come off in a railroad train. It was on the track. Somebody grabbed the thing, puts it in a bag, brings the patient and the hand to the center, and I had to do a promo, and I had to do it on my feet. And the guys, one of the pieces of advice was, never let the ice in the bag touch the skin, because that's wrong. So I go, and it was during Saturday Night Live. I think they thought I was being funny. I said, what to do when your hand falls off tomorrow at 8? So there you go. Well, maybe not. Okay, Jim, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll go to somebody in Spencertown. And I know, Joe, you can make that a little bit darker. Okay.
Looks like Lee.
Lee in Spencertown. Okay, go, Lee.
I have a student. I'm a high school teacher, and I have a student who's just recently been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And I'm just curious if you could explain a little bit of what fibromyalgia is and how it affects the pain centers of the brain. Which parts of the brain? Is it a strictly neural problem, or is it muscles? What can you tell me about it?
Sure. Fibromyalgia is actually a very interesting syndrome in a lot of ways. But to answer your question, it is the etiology of it, or why it happens, we don't totally understand. People who have it experience a hypersensitivity or an increased sensitivity to pain, to touch, and to make a proper diagnosis, people will have certain, we call them trigger points, on various parts of their body that you can touch them and they'll experience a lot of pain. They'll just have this heightened sense that things hurt. A lot of times, especially in women, that I'll see them and tell me their legs are swollen, their ankles are swollen, and when you look, they really aren't, but they have this feeling, this sensation that they are. What we do know is there's this substance called substance P that we all make, that people with fibromyalgia seem to have a bit more. It's actually made in the spinal cord. And it's felt that through this, that these people experience heightened sensitivity to touch. And so everything is magnified.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lee.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a very short break. We're just seconds, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Colesville, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas. Bassett.org. And Midwives of the Hudson Valley and Capital Region, offering women's health care, maternity care, and home birth services throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital Regions. Midwives support WAMC.com.
And we are back, and we are delighted that you're all here with us and with Dr. Dean LeMary, a board-certified family medicine physician practicing in Glenville, New York. Very bright guy. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. Let's go to Merle. Merle, you're on. Is it Merle? Hello. Uh-oh. Merle.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay, my general question is, we have, my general doctor is in Greenwich, New York, And if I have a problem like I had a little dog bite, and I said, well, I better go in the next day and have them look at it. Well, they wouldn't look at it because they just sent me to the emergency room. Now, back in the day, we used to just see your general doctor, and they would take care of the general small problems. Now they just send you to the emergency room.
Okay, so Merle's question, I think, is, I don't want to put words in his mouth, are we overusing the emergency room? Because, you know, you call a specialist up and they'll say, if this is an emergency situation, hang up the phone, dial 911, and go to the emergency room.
But it's not really an emergency.
Yeah, we got it. Okay, well, let's have the doc answer.
Yeah, I think to your point, there absolutely is some overuse to the emergency room. I think part of the answer to your question also gets into the training of the physician as to how much experience they have with repairing minor lacerations, for example. Or even how long they've done it, could have been exposed to it during training, and it could be years before somebody actually walks in with one. And so their comfort level with treating these things may not be very good. And so they certainly want you to get reasonable treatment for the problem.
Makes sense.
But it would be nice if more of the primary care folks were able to have these skills and be comfortable with them, and a lot of them don't necessarily get them in training. I did an internal medicine. I'm internal medicine and pediatric trained, and in my internal medicine residency, we did very little of this. I did a couple rotations in the emergency room where I was exposed to it, did some simple suturing, but that's it. And so it's kind of a combination of those things.
I mean, is general doctoring going that way? I mean, it seems like our general doctor is just a referral service.
I can't comment on your physician, but I think, you know, it depends on where you train and the things you've been exposed to. For lower level things like that, where there are urgent care centers, which are certainly faster than
you. Yeah,
but
we don't have one in this general area.
Well, you know, Merle, it's interesting that you say that, because when I was a kid at Camp Bronx House in Copaic, New York, there was a Dr. Bowerhan. Dr. Bowerhan not only did all the things you're talking about, I mean everything, because of the camps and the rest in the area, but he also compounded the medicines right there. Them days is gone forever. Hey, Merle, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Thank you, Merle.
Yeah.
Let's go to Daniel in Johnstown, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. In fact, perfect. Daniel, go ahead.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
I went for my physical, and when he did the private area parts, he didn't even look what he felt, and he said, have something called a bag of worms. And he said it's like leather. And he wants me to get an ultrasound, but he said not to worry too much about it. And now, is that a real medical term, a bag of worms? And am I okay?
It's a nice descriptive medical term. I think my guess is you'll probably be okay. What he's probably feeling are veins in that area, which is something that is not necessarily uncommon and is not a horrible condition. Certainly with the ultrasound, he's going to make sure there's nothing else going on, but that's very much what it sounds like.
What causes that?
It's just one of those things that happened. You've seen people with varicose veins in their legs?
Right.
You know what I'm talking about? Well, think of the same way in the scrotal area, in that area.
Okay. Thanks, Daniel. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Adam in Queensbury. Okay, Adam, you're up.
Hi. So I experienced a cut on my thumb the other day, and my mom said, you know, they say don't put hydrogen peroxide on it anymore, but I did anyway because I was, you know, it was a dirty knife and I wanted to kill any germs. What would be the best thing to clean it?
Okay, great question. Initially, soap and water is still always number one. I think early on, hydrogen peroxide initially can be okay. The thing that people do, and here's where things get out of track, maybe this is where your mother was coming from, is people then tend to use it over and over and over every day because they want to keep it clean. The problem is with things like hydrogen peroxide, some of the other topical over-the-counter antibiotic ointments like bacitracin, things that I personally don't push a lot at all, is that these things can do harm to skin that's now trying to regrow. Once you clean it, get it all cleaned out, and things are fine, you know, cover it with a Band-Aid if it doesn't need to be sutured up. Cover it with a Band-Aid. Maybe when you change the Band-Aid, little gentle washing with soap and water, and you don't need to do anything more like that and just let the new skin regrow and heal it up.
Now, what about the days when you stepped on a rusty nail and they gave you a tetanus shot?
I would still get a tetanus shot.
You would.
Is that what you're
asking about?
Yeah,
that was my question.
If you've had, for something that's a minor cut, if you've had a tetanus shot within 10 years, you're good.
Oh,
if it's a more serious thing within 5 years, if it's been longer than 5 years, probably ought to get an update.
Right.
Great question.
Adam, thanks for the question. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Yep. Let's go to Diane in Pittsfield. Diane, you're on.
Hi. I'd like to follow up on the lady that talked about fibromyalgia. My daughter is diagnosed with it, and she tried the Lyrica, but it gives her terrible headaches. She was on it for 2 weeks. And I'm wondering what other course of action the neurologist could do for her. She's in a lot of pain. She's missing work. She has two children. So I was wondering about that, Dr. Lamari.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's a tough... Fibromyalgia can be hard to treat. Lyrica certainly is one medication. There's another medication called Savella, S-A-V-E-L-L-A, which is kind of related to the group of medications that Prozac belongs to. But Savella also has an indication for fibromyalgia, so that's something you may want to look at and she with her doctors. Beyond there, people try a lot of different things to try and help with some of the discomfort. And there's not a real good, the problem is there's not a real good right answer for this, unfortunately. And that's why everything is that you've heard or maybe read is kind of vague, because there isn't a real good right answer. People have tried all kinds of medications, Tylenol, combinations with that, some other medications for nerve pain, such as gabapentin or Neurontin. But there isn't a good right answer for this. So you work your way through it. But Savella,
she's only 34 years old.
But Savella is a medication that is indicated for fibromyalgia. So you may want to discuss that with her doctor.
Thanks, Diane. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Patricia in Hudson. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I have a question about what is the politics thing to do, or what would be the practical thing to do when you're working with a number of doctors and they're contradicting each other?
Are these doctors in the same specialty or different specialties?
No, different specialty, but relating to,
whatever.
So say you have an issue and one doctor says, well, you have this condition, and the next doctor says, in fact, someone has actually said to me, that doctor is an idiot. You don't have...
Okay. Now, Patricia.
You have this.
Patricia, you are, you have a first name you gave us, but you're anonymous. So, why don't you tell us about the condition?
In one issue, this has actually happened to me more than once over years, and at one point, it was so frustrating that I left the medical system altogether and said these people are nuts. But recently, I was told that I had. Pulmonary hypertension by one doctor, and another doctor said, no, you don't. And then another doctor said, well, we need to do these tests. And another doctor said, no, you don't. And the first doctor's tests, I actually did, and the test came back normal. And, they don't seem to be able to agree across specialties. And certainly, if you have a heart issue, you're going to listen more closely to the cardiologist. But when you get a very firm, this is something that's really wrong with you and you need to take care of it from another doctor, it's hard not to take that pretty seriously, too.
Okay, so you're getting different diagnoses from different doctors. Doctor, you're on. 15?
It's an interesting quandary the way you laid that out. Specifically with pulmonary hypertension, I'm assuming one of the things they did was an echocardiogram. And you can see oftentimes certain changes there that may indicate that somebody has pulmonary hypertension. I think if this is being done because there's some breathing issue or some question of a lung issue, that talking with a lung specialist and just what I tell patients is you lay it on the line. Okay, so one guy said this, one guy said not this, so explain this to me. And people may not know what's going on, and then tell me what would be our next best steps. I mean, it sounds like you're in that kind of a quandary.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem for me in particular is that I don't want to be ungrateful or to be a doubter or whatever, and you don't want to alienate your doctor.
Yeah, it's a very good point.
And it's very difficult when they are, you know, they're all supposed to know in something more than I do, clearly. But if I start to feel like, some of these people must be wrong because someone else is right, how to actually, you know, to deal with the discrepancies between them and be a good patient, it's very difficult to figure out how to cope with their interactions with each other as well.
Okay, last up, stuck, and then we have to move on.
Yeah, I think those are good points, and those are difficult. But I think at some point, you know, this is your life, this is your health.
Yeah.
And it really needs to be squared away. And sometimes for some people can be a difficult conversation. But, you know, and sure. People may not know what's going on. We don't always know what's going on. And people, if that's the truth, people should at least tell you. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay, Patricia, thank you for your call. Sorry
thank
we couldn't
you.
Do more. Thanks. Let's go to Eliza. Oh, well, okay. All right, let's go to Eliza.
Hi, Alan.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm wondering if the doctor can comment on the link or lack of link between vaccinations and autism. I'm really concerned that, for instance, there was just a mumps outbreak in California and that people aren't really taking the public health aspect of vaccinations very seriously when they...
Was that mumps or measles?
I think it was mumps in California recently.
Well, I heard a piece this morning about measles. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Your point is well taken. I think the first and most important point is people need to remember these diseases still exist. We don't see them a lot in this country because we're lucky that we vaccinate a lot of people. Mm-hmm. The things like this, when things like come out, you know, did the vaccine cause this or did it cause that? In this particular question, you know, they ask questions and people start to look into it. There's been a lot of research done, not just in this country, but also in Europe. Looking at this question, and all of it has come out, fortunately, on a side that there really doesn't cause autism. I mean, autism begins to see characteristic of autistic children when they're around 15 months to 2 years. You can begin to notice things. Coincidentally, we give vaccines, measles, mumps, rubella at about 15 months. We also give chickenpox at a year. On routine basis. But folks have looked at this question. They've looked at it a lot. There are numerous studies out there, like I say, from around the world, and they're not showing a link.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Liza. Okay, and we'll now go to Liz in Glenmont. Liz, you're on.
Hello. I actually have sort of a two-part question. Difficulty with discomfort in the hip, and my GP had suggested last time to take glucomine, chondroitin,
glucosamine.
Yeah, and I just wondered the difference between that and just the glucomine.
Glucosamine.
I've seen the two things. I've seen one without the chondroitin. Well, I just wondered.
Yeah, glucosamine and chondroitin. Chondroitin's another potential component of cartilage. And theoretically, it's supposed to help restore some of the joint integrity. Do these things really do that? Hard to tell. What has the literature told us? A lot of the literature is in people with fairly severe hip or knee pain. And there's literature a little bit on both sides. Some of it says it really doesn't do much, and others that it seems to offer some help in people with milder arthritis. I think, at least what I tell patients who want to try it, there's very little downside. That's the nice thing, is there's very little downside. And so I'll tell people, try it for a couple of months. If it helps you, if you think it helps you, stay with it. If not, get rid of it, because it's not cheap either.
Okay, Liz,
right,
thank you.
Right.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
The other part, can I ask the other part?
Yeah, go ahead.
I had gone to the orthopedist, I guess, a few months ago, and he, after looking at the x-ray, he said, I'm surprised that you're not in more pain. Not that I'm really in pain, but I'm obviously I'm hobbling, you know, I'm resisting putting pressure in, and it's sometimes worse than others. And so he suggested, or maybe I told him I had already been going to a physical therapist, but then he didn't give me any more information what to do after that, make an appointment or what. I'm getting a great deal of pressure, you know, from my family saying, you know, you need to have surgery, and you know, so you can do things, and so I'm just wondering whether I have to go through my GP, or I just have to go back to him.
I think if you're established with the orthopedic surgeon already, it sounds like you need another visit and to talk about all your options, including surgery, and you make what you want to do.
But then, Dean, there's an old question about you give a guy with a knife, you know, a job. So does it depend on who we go to, what the remedy is?
Most surgeons will tell you when it hurts them enough that you can't stand it, you let me know.
Okay. Hey, Liz, got to go. A lot of people behind you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. And now we go to Kim in Half Moon. But before we do, I remind everybody, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Now's the time to call. Kim in Half Moon, go.
Hello. I have a question. Is there any medical proof or finding a correlation between a gluten intolerance or gluten problems and rheumatoid arthritis, or maybe some other types of autoimmune diseases?
With rheumatoid arthritis specifically, I'm not aware off the top of my head. With other things, hypothyroidism, diabetes, things just to kind of keep a look for. If there's a true gluten sensitivity, and the reason I say that is gluten sensitivity seems to be one of the things of the day. Everybody, I'm avoiding gluten, but if this is a true documented gluten sensitivity, those are some things.
And how can you find that?
That diagnosis is actually made, it's not hard to do, but it's a biopsy diagnosis of this first part of the small bowel, which a GI specialist can easily do.
Right.
There are some screening antibody tests that can be done to say, you know what, here's somebody who may actually have this.
And when you're having a colonoscopy, that's a good time for them to do it, right?
And I did have those because I was having such broad symptoms. I did have all of the screenings and all of the blood tests, and it was almost as a last resort that somebody said, well, why don't you try and give up gluten? And I went, that's the craziest thing I ever heard of. And almost within a couple of weeks after I gave up the gluten, I started to feel better. I had like a lot of just real tiredness, achy joints, achy body. And then all of my digestive issues that I never knew, I just thought that's the way everybody's was, that I've had my whole life, really disappeared. So I talked to my doctor, and I didn't want him to think I was crazy. But he said, you know, if the gluten, if it makes you feel better, then you don't need it. So,
okay. Can't argue with that. I'm glad you feel better.
Yeah. And Kim and Dean, I have to say, we have to take a short break. Thank you for calling, Kim. Appreciate it very much. Yeah. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing inpatient and outpatient care for New York's Capital Region, reinventing healthcare one patient at a time, ellismedicine.org. And Audubon Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of imports, specializing in late model Volkswagen, Audi, and BMW, AudubonTechnic.com.
And we are back. Thank you, Zachary. There are two people up on the wall, and therefore there are three phones that are free. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Miriam in New Paltz. Okay, Miriam, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the opportunity to be on the air. I'm calling to recommend a book that I actually first heard about on WAMC a couple of years ago. It's by a Peter Ubel, U-B-E-L. That's U-B-E-L. It's called Critical Decisions, How You and Your Doctor Can Make Better Decisions Together. And I like this book so much that even after I read it from the library, I went and bought a copy so I can loan it to friends. It's that good a book. So I really recommend Critical Decisions by Dr. Peter Ubel. He's also a bioethicist and a behavioral scientist.
Miriam, thank
that was
you.
All.
Thanks for the hint. Appreciate it a lot. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Maureen in Albany. Maureen.
Yes, I wanted to ask the doctor what his thoughts were on some of the studies that are coming out now that some of the statins may, in fact, cause peripheral neuropathy.
Sure. I think that, like anything, everything is risk versus benefit. All the medications we give, I can't think of hardly any medications that we give for anything that don't have potential downsides that we either know about or over time people find out about. With statins in particular, the first one came out, a lot of people don't remember this, but really about 26 years ago. And the reason a lot of people don't know that is because drug advertising wasn't real prevalent back then. So they've been around a long time. But with regard to side effects that they or anything else might have, it's all risk versus benefit. And this is part of the discussion you have with your doctor is, you know, what's your risk? Is the potential here? And are any risk outweighing any potential benefits? And then you decide where you want to be and you go from there.
Okay.
Thank you, Maureen.
Thank you very much.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Well, let's go to Claudia in Leverett. Okay, Claudia, you're on.
Hello. I am also calling about the dreaded fibromyalgia issue, as I suffer from it. My comment is that I have a concern about the fact that the term is being used so commonly as a diagnosis of a condition when it is really more like migraines. It's a symptom or part of a cluster of symptoms associated with issues such as autoimmune disease, especially hypothyroid in my case, exposure to environmental toxins, and it can be an important indicator. When I was hearing that woman talk about her daughter, I would not want anybody to leave it untreated and go on suffering, but it is important to notice what makes it worse, what makes it better, pay attention to that. I don't think the emphasis should be so much on treatments and miracle cures. In the last year, there were a lot of headlines about a cure has been found for fibromyalgia, now we never have to suffer from it ever again. We just haven't gotten that far. and I would love to see more found out about it and more relief for it. I personally find that acupuncture helps a great deal with support for the immune system and things like that. But just for all those people who are suffering out there, one of the things we're suffering from is the medical industry just saying, you have this, go get on that, and you're fine now, you know, you don't have any pain anymore. If you do, it's all in your head. It really is an important kind of litmus test of what are you hanging around and what is it doing to you, and it's really not a final diagnosis.
Okay, Dr. Lemaire?
No, I think your points are well taken, especially what makes it worse, what makes it better. As you know, you learn to find your limits and make your way to function through every day, and that's, you know, I think good sound advice for people, and hopefully someday we will learn more and we'll be able to do more than we do. As I commented earlier,
there isn't
a good right answer here, unfortunately.
Okay. No, there are a lot of good questions. That's where we need to be pointing.
Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Amy in Selkirk. Amy, did we lose you before? Amy? Well, I guess Amy's not there. All right, let's go to Gerard in, let's go to Gerard in New Windsor. Okay, Gerard, you're on.
Doctor, I have a problem with high potassium in the blood.
Okay.
And what it amounts to, I'm slated to have an operation on my throat this coming Monday, February the 2nd. And, of course, there was preliminary blood work done by my local physician. Plus, I had an electrocardiogram today. Now, everything is pretty much in line except the potassium. I think the bracket is, what, 3.5 to 5? Mine is 6.2. And my physician said there's a good chance that the physician in Westchester, you know, won't be able to do the surgery with this electrolyte problem.
I think what you're going to need to do, if what you said is true, that's something, I have to say this, that's something that needs to be taken care of fairly quickly.
It is high,
I think. That's a little higher than most people are comfortable with. The first thing you need to do is get that repeated very quickly. Just to make sure that it's true, because oftentimes these things are errors, and then it's really not a problem. But if indeed it is, it needs to be taken care of right away.
Doctor, when I saw my physician this morning, he had his nurse draw blood for another test. He referred to it as blood plasma test, and he seemed to think there was something in the test tube that sometimes causes these high readings. Now, normally I'm up in the 5.3, 5.4 range, but this is the highest I've ever had.
Okay, you got your answer. Thank you very much, Gerard. We're going to take some other calls. Appreciate it very much. Yeah, bye-bye. Let's go to Kathy in the Berkshires. Okay, Kathy, you're on.
Hi. I'm elderly, and I have no trouble when I have lunch at home, and I usually might have soup, and then half an hour later, sandwich. But when I go out since December a couple of times, and I've had French fries and a whole sandwich or salad, and I lose it. I upchuck quickly afterwards, like within a half hour.
Doctor.
See your doctor. You need to see your doctor about this. I'm not sure what's going on, but this is something obviously that somebody needs to look into.
Maybe something like the cooking oil or something like that. Yeah, you never know. Hey, Kathy, we're sorry we can't help. But
thank you.
See your doctor, Kathy. Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Jennifer in Rock Hill. Okay, Jennifer, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call.
I'm a 44-year-old woman, and a year ago I was diagnosed with a very large precancerous colon polyp, which ended up requiring part of my bowel to be removed. And I'm just curious, no family history, I don't drink, I've never used drugs, I eat organic, I'm not overweight, you know, what there might be that I'm doing that could have caused this, or something I could do to prevent this from happening again. The doctors looked pretty scared when they told me this news, such as you at my age.
Well, that certainly is concerning news that somebody at your age with no family history and apparently a very healthy individual. You didn't do anything. Sometimes things just happen. I think at this point, you know, continue to live your life, eat a good diet, stay active. Obviously, you're probably going to get screened again in another few years. And, you know, sometimes genetics do things, and we don't really have a good answer for that at this point.
Is there any contributing factors, you know, food or lifestyle or exposures, anything like that, that I should avoid?
I don't have any particular foods I would have you avoid. I would eat regular things. There's some literature out there that aspirin may have some prevention with colon cancer. I don't routinely recommend that for people, but there is literature out there. I just think eating a regular healthy diet, 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and just keeping a good lifestyle, keeping your weight good, and we'll all pray for the best.
Good luck. Good luck, Jennifer. Oh,
thank you very much.
Sure. Let's go to Dick. Whoa, that was a mistake. Let's go to Dick in Longmeadow. Dick, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is to come back to fibromyalgia. I read in a New England Journal one of the articles, once you've used the normal FDA-approved drugs for fibromyalgia, some of the rheumatologists are going back to the older tricyclic antidepressants in lower doses, bicyclics and quadricyclics, amitriptyline, nortriptyline, protriptyline. And I was just wondering if you could comment on that, sir.
Yeah, I've used those medications in the past for this. Yeah, as I mentioned before, I think the bottom line is there is no right answer. There's a couple drugs that are FDA approved, and that's pretty much it. Back in the day before these drugs, we all used some of the tricyclics. And sometimes they help, sometimes they don't. Some of the, as I like to tell patients, I try and take advantage of some of the side effects of them, which can be muscle relaxant properties, which is very helpful because some of these folks are pretty tight. Some anti-anxiety properties, tricyclics, especially amitriptyline, is also a medication that's been used a long time for nerve pain. And so sometimes some of these medications will help. Unfortunately, nothing that we do is going to give a phenomenal cure. But sometimes some of these things help. And as I like to say to people, sometimes we get lucky. But we don't have a good right path to walk down with this disorder.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Dick. And we have heard from Mark, who says, "Dear doctor, high blood pressure patients are told to avoid things that increase blood pressure, things like salt. So why is it that exercise helps blood pressure? Doesn't exercise also raise blood pressure when you work out? If so, why does exercise help?"
Okay, well, he's right. When you do exercise, usually your blood pressure will go up to some degree. The reason it helps in the long run, there are several things. The first thing is, importantly, it helps the heart to work more efficiently. If you look at the pulse of athletes, it's generally pretty low. It's much lower than average. Normal pulse is 60 to 90 beats a minute. A lot of people who work out regularly and athletic may have pulse rates in the 50, which is okay. So it helps the heart to work much more efficient, which is going to lower your blood pressure. Regular exercise also helps people to keep your weight down, which again, all of us have some set point in our weight where when you hit it, it's going to start to affect things.
Sure.
So exercise will help with that.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, I work out every morning, never miss. I'll take my blood pressure sometimes before I go on the bike or whatever I'm doing for an hour. And when I get off, it's always lower.
Yeah. Also, after a while, too, to let out that heat, you dilate. Mm-hmm. To let out the heat if you've worked up a good sweat, and that can certainly bring your blood pressure down. And also, you know, things kind of extend into the rest of our life. If some people who work out regularly tend to eat a little better, tend to watch themselves a little bit better, and all of that helps also. And so sometimes, you know, we get too focused on one thing, and we don't actually see how it affects everything and how it all interplays to give us a good outcome.
You are absolutely right, I think. You know, when I started in my earlier life doing all of the working out, I also said, okay, but then you have to do all the other stuff too, so better eating and the rest. Okay, let's go to Claudia in Rhinebeck. Claudia in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I just want to make a comment about fibromyalgia. I've had it since 1985, and the best cure that I have found is to entirely stop eating gluten and stop eating sugar. That's just a comment.
Well, I don't think, this is Alan, the political scientist, not the doctor, but I don't think eating less sugar is a bad idea for anything.
Correct.
Yeah.
But that's not my question.
Okay.
My question is this. I've had bilateral mastectomy for cancer. I was not a candidate for implants because I had to have radiation after the mastectomies. I am, however, a candidate for reconstruction via deep flap. So far, what I have found out is that insurances will pay via their claim numbers. I'm a Medicare recipient. Medicare does not have those same numbers, so the surgeons won't take Medicare because the reimbursement is $3,000 for a $30,000 to $50,000 surgery, depending on how many surgeons are needed. So my question is, aren't there laws stating that breast cancer survivors have a legal right to have reconstruction?
Claudia, your voice is busting up,
I don't know the answer to your question. If there is a specific law that says you're entitled to reconstructive surgery, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
You may want to call your Medicare carrier and talk to them about what they reimburse, because they'll tell you specifically what they will and will not reimburse for.
I have.
But I don't know about a law.
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
And what I am told is, you know, this is the amount, which is $3,000.
The other thing you might try, Claudia, is calling your congressman. You know, sometimes when they make a call to an insurer, makes a world of difference.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye.
You're welcome.
Bye. So that does it. We are out of time. My apologies to no one because nobody was left on the line. I want to thank Dr. Dean Lemery for joining us today. Dean, you were wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Come back again. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones and doing it very well. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WMC.org/VoxPop. And remember that the lockbox, we are coming so close. We have $10,000 from Berkshire Bank. It's a lot of money. Think of what $10,000 in your wallet would look like. That's a lot of money. Anybody who can help now, we really need you. You just go to WAMC.org and just click on the lockbox or call here, 1-800-348-2551. But just do something. Thanks and have a good day.